Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Be authentic in everything that you do. Blair James. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Storybox Podcast. I'm Jay Phantom, and I'm your host. Guys, this week we've got Blair James on the show with us. Now, Blair is the owner and founder of the iconic brand, globally renowned as well, Bondi Sands. Now, on this podcast, we get to talking about how Blair's dad played a massive influence in shaping his life and his career, helping him create his passion and innovation for business as well. We also get to talking about how Bondi Sands started. So going from being a tanning salon to then becoming a globally renowned product on the shelves that you can buy. And also some other things. So talking about how you can create authenticity in your life and then translate that into your business as well. So lots of good content in this episode, guys. So without me continuing on, let's dive into the story box and hear Blair's story. So I'm sitting here with Blair James. Now, Blair, you are the owner of what company?
Bondi Sands, the Australian tan.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you one question before we go back and you tell me your entire story. And what is your, because I believe you've had quite a bit of success with Bondi Sands. So what do you define success as in your own life?
I think success has always been for me having control over your, you know, the own direction for your life. That's always been very important to me, is, you know, why I went into business. It still motivates me to this day. And it's about having freedom to chase your dreams, being able to spend more time with your family if you need to. So that's still, yeah, the main motivation for what I do.
That's good, man. All right. So now we're going to get into all the fun stuff, how you ended up, because we're talking before about sort of little bits of your life. So I want to hear a little bit about how everything sort of got started. So if you could go back to, was Bondi Sands always something you wanted to do?
Not Bondi Sands. That kind of evolved from a previous business, but I was definitely exposed to entrepreneurship and branding very early on. My dad, you know, was an entrepreneur himself, had his own store in the UK when we lived there when I was a kid. So I sort of was exposed to business at that age. I loved brands as a kid. I always loved, you know, Nike was one that I've spoken about a lot that really motivated me and I guess exposed me to, you know, why a brand talks the way they do, why they promote themselves in certain ways and understand the psychology that's linked to all of that. So that really interested me as a kid. And
why was it Nike specifically? Why did you like that the most?
I think it was tied back to Michael Jordan was a big part of that. I was part of my family. My brother was in athletics. I'd later get into athletics. And so I was kind of, that was really the brand I was exposed to first. But and I guess the thing I took in very early on from Nike was that they very rarely talked about product. You know, it was all about a feeling. Like if you look at some of their early ads, they were literally just someone running along a road, first thing in the morning, it might be slightly drizzling or whatever. And it's that emotion they get across in their imagery and the way they speak. Then they make clothes on a photo of a shoe or something like that. But there's no talking about, you know, the technology in the shoe. It's all about a feeling. And that's what I think it worked on me. It drew me closer to the brand. So I think that was really what it was in the beginning. It was more the not trying to just market a product, which I found interesting.
Right. And you spoke a little bit about your dad, how he was a big influence in your life. What did he do for a living?
So he was a engineer by trade. So he was engineering manager at Ford Motor Company for a number of years. Wow. And then he was an older dad. So he had me when he was 55. And he retired in the late 80s and decided he'd like to move back to the UK. Well, it didn't start as a move back to the UK. We decided to go over for a couple of months, ended up staying there for 3 years. And my dad, funny enough, opened an Australian store in the UK, so importing Australian goods into the UK. So finally I'm doing literally the same thing, but he was bringing in traditional Australian products like oil skins and riding saddles and all equestrian stuff. So that's what he was doing. And so he did that for a number of years, and you know, the business didn't go well. And so we ended up losing most of our money, going broke off the back of that business. And so it was a huge learning curve going from being very, I think, stable financially as a family, and then seeing, you know, what a business can do to a family if it isn't run properly. And I took note of the mistakes he made. There was also I enjoyed looking at his ambition as well. So there was the good and the bad. Off the back of that, you know, you go from being very stable in life to then having literally next to nothing. Yeah. It teaches you to be scrappy. So it was an experience that I wouldn't change now, because you go from, having everything then to having nothing. And, it definitely changes you as a person.
So what did it – how did it make you feel? Did it motivate you even more?
Yeah, I think it – I just always pictured getting back to what we were like when I was younger. And it's still something that I carry with me today, is that there's a worry about not being secure again, and that's what really drives me forward. It's, you know, with Bondi, it's always about, you know, what can we do next? We need to be better. We need to be better. Always moving forward. So, you know, as a kid, I was always just looking at ways to make money to, so I could have the things that all the other kids had. So it was either – selling things I already had, or, I used to love my basketball shoes, Nike basketball shoes, but we couldn't always afford to have them. So mum would say to me, if you can get half the money for the shoes, you can have them. So I would treasure these shoes like they were literally made of gold.
My mum was the same way.
Yeah.
Games of basketball.
Yeah. And so what I used to do, I never wear them outside. Before every game, I would scrub them with a toothbrush, and I'd have a little jar of water with, a nifty sort of cleaner. And I'd clean the shoes, sole and all, before every single game. So they were spotless always. And then I'd sell them to the kids at school after I had them for 6 months, but they were literally brand new. But I'd sell them to the kids at school for half of what I paid them for, what I bought them for. And so the kids looked at those as good value. And that allowed me to go and buy the next pair. So it's just things like that. It makes you value what you have. Look at opportunities deeper than what other people would. There's always something around you that you can either monetize or you can use for, to leverage up to something else.
Yeah, I think I sort of had a very similar experience growing up with my family. We didn't really have all that much. My parents worked their absolute butts off to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. But, we were content. We were happy kids, run outside. And I remember when we didn't have too much money to buy extra stuff. And one of the things that I loved when I was 13 was basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So I got introduced to that, from my Filipino mates. They all had shoes. They had the Nikes, they had Addies and everything like that. I didn't have any shoes. I had probably runners from Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they didn't have any grip on them. I just, I was just wanted to play.
Yeah.
And then I remember my first ever basketball game. I needed basketball shoes. And a friend of mine lent me his basketball shoes. And he's a kicker, right? My very first experience of basketball shoes was blisters on blisters because I was wearing someone else's shoes.
Yeah.
I'm like, stuff this. If I'm going to continue playing, I'm going to buy some shoes.
Yeah.
The first ever shoes that I bought, funny enough, were Nikes.
Mm-hmm.
So 100%, man. The experience of going and resonating with a brand as well, because I was the same way. Nike, everyone else is wearing them. I'm going to wear them too, mm-hmm. even though I can't really afford them. So what could you see that was the main issues with your father's business?
There was a couple. The first one, and at the time you don't realize. Mm-hmm. It's only when you look back at it, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But
bliss.
The location for the store, foot traffic wasn't there. It was a brand new development. didn't have the money to really market the store and really show people where to come and shop for these things. I don't know if my dad had done enough market research as well around who's actually buying this stuff. There was definitely a big interest in Australian products back then with Crocodile Dundee launching and all that stuff. So, so I think lack of resources to really market the product, the store properly. Location was a big factor, and I think just lack of market research for understanding how much people actually were involved in the category he was trying to sell. So you couple all those together, you group all those together, and at the time when the Australian dollar was worth 30 pence, every pound you're losing $3. So you go through money very quickly. So, I think that was sort of the main issues, and that's something today, like that I remember those things. Whenever I look at making a new product for Bondi or moving to a new category, or we're going to market a certain way, we research everything. We understand who we're talking to. We make sure there's an audience for what we're making. So we're definitely taking up a lot of that experience. I still take on board today.
So how old were you when that all happened?
So moved to the UK when I was about 8, yep. And then came back when I was about 11.
And what did you guys do, like, for work, or what did your father do for work when you got back?
So off the back of that, he really lost his confidence off the back of that. It was, I guess, a bit soul destroying for him. He was quite successful and then lost everything. We lost the family home off the back of that, and I think he really took it on board that, he'd almost destroyed the family in a way. Mm. Not that he did. I never felt like I really went without, because they were always great parents. Mum stepped up. She hadn't worked, since she was, mid-20s. Wow. She went back to work. Didn't have a lot of skills or education. So she went back just doing a reception job. And so she was really... I think at the time she was bringing home about maybe $380 a week or $400 a week after tax. So it was like looking after a family of five on that sort of money. That's
tough.
And this is the stuff you look back on now and just go, like, how did she do that?
Yeah.
You don't realize at the time. You're very naive as a kid. I knew that we didn't have what everyone else had, but I didn't realize how mum was, what mum was doing. Mm. So it was really mum who got us through the next few years. And eventually my dad went back to work at Ford Motor Company about 4 or 5 years later. And then funny enough, we were just getting back on our feet, and then he passed away. So it was, it was one knock after another for probably a decade of maybe more, of one sort of setback after another. So it was, a lot of education, a lot of learning through that time, and really shaping me into, I guess, who I am now through those experiences. And part of me, I look back at it and it's some painful memories, but then half of it I wouldn't change, because it is, developed who I am today.
Yeah.
So you kind of like, you need to take the good with the bad.
So what was going, like, how did you react to your father's death?
It was very sudden. So it was a massive shock. I was in year 12 at the time. I remember I don't think I left my room for about 3 days afterwards. I was literally just sort of inconsolable about that. And, obviously didn't go to school for about 3 months during year 12.
Yep.
And, just got to the point, like, I just thought, what's the point? Was that really like, oh, what's the point? It doesn't matter. Like, school's not important. Mm. I definitely had that attitude. Didn't want to go back to school, really. And then eventually mum convinced me to go back to school. And at the time I was getting right into athletics. Yep. And I guess funneled a lot of that into athletics. My dad loved me doing athletics. So it was, that was a really good way of me funneling some sort of that, or funneling that energy through something productive. Mm-hmm. And I really put everything that I did on the athletics track, it was all in my mind, was dedicated to him.
Yep.
So that was one way that I think sport really helped me through, or enabled me to help me move on, at least in some degree.
What were some things that your mum said to you to get you outside of your room and go back to school?
I think the main stuff was, you know, probably pretty common things that people would say when, you know, someone, you lose someone close, is that more that, you know, your dad wouldn't want you to give up. You know, your dad always thought you, you know, were special. You were meant to do something. You know, he wouldn't want to see you giving up. That was what she used to say a lot. Wow. So yeah. And that was something that, you know, she always encouraged me and made me feel, and I think most parents do this, well, I would assume they do, is that, you know, they made me feel like there was a future for me. There was always, you know, I was meant to go and do something with my life. So that was, I always felt like they nurtured, I guess, that direction in my life to better myself. So, yeah, so I do owe them a lot for that.
So was your father your number one mentor?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. We spent so much time together, as you'd, you know, imagine with most fathers, but he, yeah, I mean, he, even though, and this is one of those things where you have to take the good with the bad.
Yeah.
When he wasn't working, he just wanted to spend every minute with me. So every school athletics meet, he was there. Every basketball game, he was there. He was always there to take me to training. And I think he just loved, you know, seeing me develop, and, you know, his life then became, well, my life then became his life. And so if he didn't lose everything and continue to work crazy hours like he used to, I wouldn't have had those years in my life and, you know, and really developed, I think, who I am as a person, you know, through the time that I spent with him. So you have to take with the good with the bad.
100%.
Yeah.
I've had very similar experiences to you. Like a lot of loss growing up. One of my, I think, my mentors, big one, was my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
So my mum's dad. We used to go to his house all the time. He used to teach me pretty much who I am today. Like all my teachings, philosophies is thanks to my grandfather and my parents, of course. But my grandfather was like, he was like in business as well. Mm-hmm. He did a 3-year managerial course in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Gave him a heart attack,
yeah,
but he still did it.
Yeah.
I still have that same mentality, you know, like he used to tell me, don't put off for tomorrow, what can be done today?
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say to me as well, Jared, if you don't ask, you don't get. Like those sayings I take with me today and I put them into practice. So I understand, like, when you lose someone that's that important to you, it sort of gives you a kick up the backside and it's like, oh, crap. What am I going to do now?
Mm.
It's like, am I going to motivate myself? Am I going to, you know, push on? And like, it takes time. Like time is one of the biggest things to help someone get over a traumatic experience like loss.
Yeah.
And so where did you go from like athletics in terms of job prospects?
So that sort of took me through to, like, I was at that point determined to do athletics full time. You know, wanted to be, you know, a sprinter at that point. Had a was training a lot at that time. Had a knee injury, which I thought was just a short term thing. Had some bone bruising in my left knee, and it just was just not getting better. It was taking months, and I tried to get back to the track, and it just wouldn't happen. It was just, you know, knee just wouldn't hold up for some reason. And it was just like, it was really a combination of a few circumstances where it changed the direction of my life, really. It was mum had just been diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And so it was kind of like, I need to go and earn money. You know, I can't keep, you know, working casual jobs and, you know, with no real direction. So that was when I went into real estate. And did it. I took up a traineeship with Ray White, and so I did that, and it was really just about, you know, making sure we have enough money coming in and to support mum and everything else. And it was, I think at the time, still in shock from my dad being gone probably 3 years by this time, and then mum getting sick. So it was all these, it was just one thing after another. And it was, so when I was training, I was at university as well, and it was funny. I remember this is one thing mum said to me, which I think pushed me almost realign me to what I was meant to do. I was doing occupational health and safety while I was training, and I was just like, I did it because my dad always believed in university, and I just felt like I should do that. I owed it to him, and I hated it. Like, I remember being in class and like, you know, everyone else in the class was so excited about their assignments, stuff like that. I'm like, I don't care about this. And I dropped out 2 years in, and mum said to me, she said, oh, I knew you were going to drop out. And I'm like, oh, thanks. Great vote of confidence. And she's like, no. She's like, you're always meant to do your own thing. You just always been like that. You need your own business. You need to do that. So that was like, you know, almost taking me back to as a kid. And I was like realizing that's what I was meant to do. So I remembered that. And so went through a period there where, worked in real estate and then worked in retail for a bit. And then when mum passed away, I moved down to Port Melbourne, and mum left me a small amount of money that I was able to put into, I was going to do my own clothing store because I worked in real estate in retail for a couple of years as an area manager.
Okay.
And I thought to myself, oh, I'll go and start my own men's clothing store. And my brother was like, why don't you have a look at, tanning salon? I was like, once it's up and running, like, you don't have to keep reinventing yourself, a lot less risk in terms of what you're buying. I was like, that makes sense. So, you know, I had mum left me, it was around $28,000, wasn't much. It was all she had. And my brother bought into that business invest in the business, helped me get up and running. And so that was my first business that I opened in Port Melbourne. And it was like the day I opened that store, you know, we worked till 3 a.m. in that store like days before just to get it open. And I just wanted to be there. And it was just, you know, worked every day in there for the next 3 months. And because it was just, you know, it just felt like that's what I should be doing. Mm. And, you know, that's where that business that turned into Bondi Sands. It was, 7 years of customer feedback of what they loved about spray tanning, what they didn't like. And I really learned so much about the consumer that, you know, I would go on to then market to for the next 10 years. So it's, I still look back at those years in that salon as being, you know, some of the, like I said, the best market research you can ever have.
Mm, 100%.
Mm.
So did you end up closing that salon down and then just moving everything to Bondi Sands, the product?
We started actually making spray solution in the salon, and we're using it in the salon. And that was sort of, you know, where the brand started. And then we're able to sell the business. It was around 2012. They just announced the ban on sunbeds in Australia there at that time. So it was, and that wasn't, you know, we definitely didn't make the move into Bondi because that was coming. It was more like, this is just a much bigger, you know, much more scalable opportunity. And so I was able to, you know, get out of that business and then, start Bondi Sands.
Wow. So what was it like? What was the process like in starting Bondi Sands? Like, was it a tough road or was it, did it come seamlessly?
Yeah, it's, you know, Bondi's, it's been an interesting road. There's definitely been some tough times, but there was always, even through the really, you know, those sort of rough patches, there was always, you just knew Bondi was, it was going to work. It just, and whether it was just because we believed it, or whether it was, you know, it just had that positioning and it had that, had a great product and positioning. But, you know, when we first started, we ran this business on a shoestring. My business partner and I were running the business out of our lounge rooms. I had, you know, a little bit of money out of the salon, not much. And I started just cleaning apartments just so it didn't eat into that money. Mm-hmm. Bondi could stand on its own 2 feet. So, yeah, I'd go around and just, you know, steam clean people's carpets and whatever just to keep money coming in during that time. And, yeah, first year it broke even, which is really unheard of for particularly, you know, like a product like that.
Yeah.
So the first year it was very tough, and Sean and I, we did everything ourselves. We didn't have money to give to anyone else to do anything. So, but we were very fortunate to come across some great partners in our first year. So our distributor who looks after all our products here in Australia, they still do distribution for our brand today. that was, you know, that was the first big leg up for the brand, and we were able to sell into Priceline in our first year. And at the time, it felt like a huge milestone, but, you know, we sold in four products into 300 doors at Priceline. And, you know, we were literally jumping over the moon. It was like, you know, couldn't believe it was happening. It was one of the most exciting things I've done in my life. And we look back at it now and we had maybe 30 centimeters worth of shelf space. Today you go into Priceline and you may see some stores close to 700 units on shelf. They have a lot of product. We own close to around 60% market share. So it's a very different story 10 years on. We supply around 22,000 stores around the world. But we always had that vision from day one. It was like we just, I don't know whether, you know, you can manifest these directions in your life, but we definitely had the vision that we were going to be the biggest self-tanning brand in the world. And we were quite public in telling people that before we even sold a product. So interesting reactions when you tell people that. But that was, you know, Sean and I are both very competitive.
Yeah.
Both come from, I guess, competitive sporting backgrounds. And, you know, I think we adopted that frame of mind with business as well. Like we literally, even brands that I remember at times we heard feedback from people at Saint-Tropez saying that, oh, we don't see Bondi Sands as a competitor because of their price point. And we're like, well, that's great, but we definitely see you as a competitor and just like everyone else in our category. So we were very competitive. We knew what we wanted and we definitely went after it, you know, with innovative products and innovative ways of marketing and looking at ways that we could build a category, not just build our brand.
Were you the first company to do self-tanning?
No, we were, at the time there was a big gap in the market and this is, you know, I still do it to this day. I walk up and down the aisles in supermarkets or Priceline or whatever and I look at everything. I look at everything from peanut butter to frozen meals and I look at price points and I look at where there's gaps. And there's gaps everywhere. There's always an opportunity. So back then it was highlighted to me through the salon, but you know, you had Saint-Tropez that was like a $60 price point. Then you had Latin, which was at, you know, $12 through $15. Saint-Tropez is a good product, but bloody expensive. Latin was more affordable, but the product was lacking. And so that really, to me, there was a huge opportunity to create a product around the 1995 salon quality, you know, product that, you know, people hadn't had before. And we came to the simple decision, and sometimes the best decisions in business are very simple. You know, I wanted to sell our product at $19.95 because I believed majority of our customers would be buying our product with pocket money because we're really, you know, marketing that 16 through 20 year olds. And so I thought if someone's, you know, buying our product with their $20 they've got for their pocket money or whatever, I want them to have change. And it was just simple as that. It was just, I thought that was a, you know, an affordable price point for a product that had good volume and was good quality. Wow. And that was something we stuck to that direction for probably, I don't think we went over 1995 until probably about 6-7 years down the track.
So how much does it cost now?
We still have all our core tanning products are all still below $20, but we have some more premium options now. So we have an Aero range and a couple others which go up to $24.95. So we're definitely still not premium price point. We're definitely not up around the $60 mark, which Saint-Tropez were. But there's a bit of variation in our pricing now.
So what makes Bondi Sands different to Saint-Tropez and all those other tanning products?
Well, when we launched, the whole selling quality direction was something that was important to us. And when we talk about selling quality, you're talking about level of active ingredients. Mm-hmm. So the DHA, which is the active ingredient in self-tan, most products in the market were around 6-7%. We were launching products at 8-9%, which was unheard of back then. And to get a product that was stable at that level and also have a blue-green dye base, which looks very natural on the skin, it gives you that olive skin tone.
Yep.
Those two areas coupled together was really unheard of, especially at $19. Mm. So that was our, I guess, a unique USP, adding in there as well that we're Australian-made and we wanted to remain Australian-made because we believed in our Australian heritage, but also a lot of people were heading overseas at that time to manufacture. We believed in supporting Australian industry, and I think 7 years later, it started to become more popular and almost fashionable to be Australian made. But that's something we've believed in. We believed in being vegan friendly from day one. We believed that no animal testing should take place on any of our products or the ingredients in our products. So that was something that we believed back in 2010, which is really only, I think, gained momentum in the last 5 years, I suppose. Wow. So we thought very deeply into what our product was. We didn't just accept it, what a manufacturer handed over and what was just a generic product for them. We took pride in developing what our product was going to be, and it had to be the best on the market.
And where did that name come from?
Yeah, well, Bondi, it typifies Australia, that lifestyle. It's a funny story. I was in America when I was younger, and it really it was so obvious that Americans just like adored Australia. That image that, they just saw us as fun-loving, sun-loving, healthy country. And, that was something that stuck with me for, 10 years. And so when we created the tanning brand, I thought, I knew the products in America were lacking in quality. They love, most of the products over there, they were very orange and caramel based, which looks very yellow on the skin. So I knew there was an opportunity there for a better product. Mm. And I thought to myself, well, if you're going to market the best tan in the world, why not link it back to that Australian healthy lifestyle and that golden image that the US has about Australia? And we didn't want to call it something typically Australian, like Australian gold or Australian bronze or whatever. I wanted it to be something that was iconically Australian and something that really, was the best example of what the Australian lifestyle is. And Bondi is that. Bondi, when you think of Bondi, it's the lifesavers, it's the, it's the surf, the golden sands, it's, the healthy, health conscious lifestyle that surrounds it. So it was, when you talk about Bondi, that really, typifies Australia. Mm. So that was why we chose Bondi. And we wanted it to be something that resonated with Australians as well, like they're overseas, something that they look at and go, oh, that's Bondi. I know Bondi. Like, I can resonate with that.
And now that product has gone all around the world. You got celebrities, really famous. Was it Kylie Jenner?
Yeah, Kylie Jenner posted. Yeah, posted, working with her.
She's
using
it too. So having that sort of publicity for this product that originated, was it in Melbourne?
In Melbourne.
And the beach is in Sydney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how funny is that? Like, there's always that rivalry between Melbourne and Sydney. But I remember when it first, like when I walked down the aisle and I first saw Bondi Sands, I'm like, what is this? Like, didn't have any clue.
Mm.
And I naively thought, you're going to think this is hilarious. Mm. I naively thought that a woman actually was the owner.
Okay.
And the founder of it, because I'm like, guys doing self-tanning didn't really resonate with me. But I was shocked when I found out that it was actually owned by a man.
Yeah.
And he's basically changed thousands, maybe millions of women's lives with this product.
Yeah.
So how does that make you feel?
That's interesting. We, very early on, BizButton and I would go to PR meetings and, they were expecting definitely women to walk in. interesting, you do a lot of trade shows around the world and there's a lot of men working in beauty. So it was that, people always ask us, do you pinch yourself where the brand's got to, have you done it? Is anything about the success of Bondi surprised you? We always want to be the world's biggest self-tanning brand. That was the goal from day one. But what you don't expect is how much people have taken Bondi into their lives. Mm-hmm. Like it's amazing. Like we see this, if someone writes something negative about Bondi Sands, a competitor or something, there's just this community online that almost jumps to our defense, and it's amazing. You can never forecast that's going to happen. You can never plan for that. You just have to obviously stick to your brand direction and what you're trying to do as a brand, but you hope it's going to resonate with people, but you never can plan for that. And that's probably one of the most things that that's probably the thing that humbles me the most, when you just see how much people love it. And it's amazing how many guys know about Bondi Sands now solely just because their partners look in the bathroom and their partner's got the cupboard full of Bondi and they just go, yeah, bloody cupboard's full of your stuff. So that's, Yeah, it's incredibly humbling. And but it also, that drives you as well. That's what I love about it. You kind of, you know how much Bondi means to people.
Yeah.
So when we launch something, it has to be good. Like we don't want to disappoint people. Mm. And, you know, I think that's why our products have driven innovation so much over the last few years, that we're not just going to launch anything. Our customers expect better. So I think that's probably, what we take out of it the most. It's a very humble experience, and, you know, you take that and you turn it into something that drives the business to be better.
Do you find there's any pressure to remain consistent?
There definitely is. Yeah. It's the market has become far more competitive. Like I said, when we launched 2012, there was, three or four brands in market. In Australia now, self-tanning market's the most competitive in the world. You know, we it definitely is. I mean, there's bigger categories overseas. So the American market's far bigger, but you can go to Priceline, we've got like 14, 15 competitors on shelf. Wow. And everybody's trying to knock you off, whether it's be new innovation or trying to do what you've already done, but cheaper. So it's getting more and more difficult to be innovative. But now we just need to look at different ways of, how do we do that? And it is becoming more difficult. And I think what we do very well as a brand is we just focus on what our direction is. We don't focus on other brands too much at all. Yes, we keep abreast of what's selling for other people and how stuff's selling for us, but we very much have a view on this is where we want to go, and we are looking 3 to 5 years down the track. And that's the vision that we follow. We try not to be distracted by what other people are doing. You can't control what other people are doing, so we'll just look after what we do best.
Mm, that's good, man. And what were some initial mistakes that you made starting Bondi Sands, or were there any?
I'm trying to think sort of early mistakes. There was – we probably had one – probably the biggest mistake, I think, as a brand wasn't too early on. It was around 2015. We were so desperate to get to the United States that, we partnered with some people that weren't right for the brand. We definitely got ahead of ourselves in wanting to get over there. I think the brand warranted a launch into the US at that time, but we should have been more patient in terms of who we aligned with. And I think we knew it at the time, but we just thought hoped it would be okay. It's a huge learning curve, because we've always been very fortunate with our partners. Everyone who's partnered with us has believed in the brand and really helped it move forward. And they also just want to be part of the brand. Mm. And that's what you need with partners, that external partners that you work with. So that was probably a lesson in patience, and just don't accept what you're being given today and hope that it's going to be right. Mm. That was a 18-month relationship that was very difficult, probably hindered the growth of the brand to an extent. And but again, it's you take the good with the bad. We learn a lesson out of that. And, we are very strict now on who we align with, and, that people really need, that our partners need to be brand fans and come from an authentic place. So that's what we learned. Mm,
that's good.
Yeah.
And what are some things that you're passionate about now?
I think as a brand, innovation is what we pride ourselves on. And again, it comes back to what our consumers want to see from us, what our customers want to see from us. So innovation is really important. You'll see a much stronger eco-friendly direction from Bondi. I think any brand today, if they're not taking responsibility of their impact for the environment, is not going to be around very long. Mm. So, and you make those changes because it's the right thing to do. It's not a marketing position. I've been saying for the last couple of years, being eco-friendly is not a brand positioning. It's just the way it needs to be. If you build your brand around solely being eco-friendly, in 5 years' time, when every brand is eco-friendly, you've lost your USP. Mm. So, that's something we are working on heavily over the next couple of years, and taking responsibility for the impact we've created as well. With plastics and that type of thing. So that's something that's important to us at the moment. And yeah, still creating great products for our consumers, offering better, better experiences with the brand. It's not just always about buying product. What can we offer on our website or through our channels that educate people, that make people feel good about themselves? I think moving the business forward or the brand forward in every way we can.
How about for yourself?
I'm so intrinsically tied to Bondi. Like, I feel Bondi is an extension of me. So, I'm a creative at heart. So I love to push boundaries. What I get the most motivation out of is seeing Bondi take a stance on something or move forward in a new direction. Mm. And moving forward in ways that, no one else has thought of. Mm. So that drives me a lot. I enjoy that direction. So it's hard for me to separate a personal direction out of Bondi, because Bondi is so personal for me.
Mm, definitely. I can imagine, like, this is personal for me.
Yeah.
So I'm passionate about this. I'm passionate about helping people grow and hear others' stories to help them grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that. It resonates with me too.
Yeah. And I think it's just, like I mentioned before, we've got millions of consumers, our customers around the world that love Bondi. So the biggest excitement I get is like when we launch a new product and people just lose their minds. And that's what we want. We want people to, like, that's why you do it. And it's definitely not about the money. That's something that, you hear a lot of business owners talk about, like, is, the money side of it. And really, I honestly believe if you don't have, yes, finances are important, but money should really be a byproduct of what you've created. Mm. It can't be the driving force. And that's, when we talk about development of product or a new marketing campaign, or it's all about making something enjoyable for the consumer first, because you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, money comes and goes quicker than you can actually make the stuff.
Yeah.
Like, so what's the point in focusing on something that doesn't really last a great deal of time?
Yeah.
So, focus your energy, focus your time and your resources, what you have, into something that's going to leave a lasting impression.
Yeah.
That's what I always say, at least.
I always said, like, when they're first starting out, we spoke before we got started on this, that I meet with a few entrepreneurs most weeks and have a chat about why, their business and why they're doing it. And a lot of the time, people say, oh, I want to do this product because it's a big category, a lot of money in it. And one of the first things I always say is, like, if you're doing this for the money, like, don't even bother starting, because, 2-3 years down the track, if you haven't made any money, like, it's going to become very tedious very quickly. And most businesses don't turn over the money they think they're going to 3 years in. So the motivation is going to run out pretty quickly if it's just solely for money, because a lot of the time it's like dedication and doing things you don't want to do for, 3-4 years before you actually make significant money out of it.
With that motivation factor, I think you've got to find something that's more powerful than just money.
Yeah.
I mean, money can be powerful for some people and it can be a major driving factor, but I think there's more powerful things than just money.
Like, oh, definitely.
Yeah. So definitely. What do you believe is the most important thing in business? Maybe a hard question.
Yeah, there's a lot. I think it needs to come back to something that you are authentically linked to and something that actually means something to you. It's, you look at the biggest brands in the world and, you look at their founders, like, they had, like, passion behind why they were creating it. If you look at, like, Steve Jobs, and he's one that I refer to a lot, is, person I admire for what he did. And it was his sole focus was about creating ease of use, making a seamless connection between the user and the interface. Mm. And that was it wasn't about money for him. It was solely about, he just wanted to create a better experience. And through that, he created the most valuable company in the world. He changed the music industry, the movie industry, the way we use our laptops, phones, the way we communicate. He changed all of that solely by having a passion about what he wanted, how he saw the world. So I think, like, you know, the most important thing is, it sounds like such a cliche, but unless it's something you're passionate about, you're just not going to be motivated to get up and do it every day. And as your team builds, as your business builds, the people around you see whether you have that passion or not. And if, unless you can be passionate enough that it becomes contagious to the people that are around you and they believe in what you believe, your business is not going to go anywhere.
That's good. Yeah, I appreciate that response, man, because it's something that I believe in myself. Yeah. So last couple of questions, because I know your times are valuable. So what does it take to have a good social media presence, you think?
I mean, we've gone through, we built our brand on social media, but it's changed. I think there's almost like I can feel or remember 4 to 5 sort of different directions that social media has taken over the last sort of 10 years. I think we're at a point now where people are just, they want to see transparency. They want to see originality, and it's not about marketing anymore. You know, I think Gary, like, I watch a lot of what Gary V talks about, a lot about, like, if you've got a brand today and if you're not treating it almost like a media company or a creative agency, then you're going to get left behind. I think it's as much about entertainment as anything else now. It's about creating, instead of marketing and spending money on advertising, it's more about you putting the money into the actual, not placement anymore so much. It's more about creating great content and engaging people that way, and bring them into your brand for your values and how you represent yourself, as opposed to, you know, a marketing message. And I think that message is only going to get stronger. I think that's definitely you know, a direction for us as a brand. Like, how do we engage people in ways outside of product? I think that's probably the main thing, to be honest. I mean, there's other ways of growing your following, like, you know, along with the influencers and everything else, but people are so, I think, have become so desensitized to influencers plugging product and everything else. They still work very well, but their content needs to be engaging. It needs to be different. It can't just be a product, you know, an influencer holding a bottle anymore. It needs to be something that is pushing some boundaries and really being transparent to who you are as a company. So I think there's a lot of brands that do it very well. But I think it's just constantly needing to evolve. And
eye-catching, needs to be, like you said, entertaining, needs to keep your focus on it.
Yeah.
Because captions as well, like, people like seeing it, they see the image first.
Yeah.
So if you can capture people with the image, then they're more likely to read the caption.
Yeah.
So the caption is not necessarily the most important thing. It's the image that you're portraying.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, ties back to, people want to see, they want to know what a brand's about. They want to know why it does these things. What does it care about? What's it, how's it thinking about the future? How it's going to reinvent itself for the future? And, you know, how are brands giving back? That's what people want to see in social media now. It's not about, you know, the fancy graphics and the, just the fancy videos. They want to see transparency from a brand, and a brand that's conscious about its impact on the world. So I think that's, you know, there's a lot of brands doing that well now, but I think that's going to be that's only going to become stronger over the next 10 years.
You can just see a trend.
Yeah. It's amplified even in the last 12 months. Probably even less, last 6 months. I feel like the pressure on brands to communicate in this way and present themselves in this way has increased massively even just the last 6 months. We felt the pressure as a brand immensely over the last 6 months. So it's amazing how quickly that's really amped up.
Last question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 3 bits of advice that you could give to someone starting out or just needing a boost in life.
I think starting out on a business, you can never do enough research. And that means researching the consumer you're marketing to, what retailer it's going into, what price point it should be at, what, you know, who are your competitors, how are you going to market it? That research never finishes. But you need to, you know, understand your product inside and out. And, you know, from that, it determines your brand positioning. Brand positioning determines everything else. Mm. Like, as soon as you determine what your brand positioning is, it determines what retail you go into, what the price point's going to be, who's your target market, how you're going to talk to them. So understanding that consumer is what it all ties back to. Understand that consumer inside and out. Once you understand the consumer, everything else is easy. So I think that, understanding your market inside and out, that's the first bit. Before you do anything, before you go and make samples or do that stuff, understand who you're making it for, and you know what you want your brand to be. That's probably number one.
Yeah.
Probably number two is, we spoke about it before, is being authentic in terms of why you're doing it. Mm. Enter into something that you're passionate about, you can offer value in, and you're not just creating like a me too product because you think there's some money in it. It's a big one. The third one, they're probably about the two big ones, I think, to be honest. Probably the third one, I think they're probably the two big ones, to be honest.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah,
they're probably the two. You've given us a lot of advice anyway, so.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much what's next for you?
Bondi is really focused on international expansion at the moment. Obviously, we're in the UK.
World domination.
Yeah. Yeah, through Europe. Just launching into Canada at the moment. So US is a big focus, obviously the biggest self-tanning market in the world. So that's a big focus for this year. We are really building out our sun care stable as a brand. So that's something that's important to us and something we've always strived to be, in addition to just a self-tanning brand. So there's that. And then personally, getting married this year. So that's a big year. Thank you. Yeah. So August, getting married. So that's going to August 10th.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Yeah.
My birthday's August 29th. So I was going to say
Well, my birthday's August 15th. So yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, August. Cool.
So there's that. So it's a big year for us. Yeah. It will be a year for me personally as well as with business as well. But it's looking forward to it though.
That's a great way to end this podcast. Really appreciate your time, Blair, for coming on and giving us all the advice and sharing your story with us.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for listening to this week's episode of the Storybox podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to hear more episodes like this one, you can do so now over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify just by searching up the Storybox. And if you got something out of this week's episode, please leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts and share it around with your friends and family. Let's start changing people's lives through powerful stories. You can also connect with the Storybox on social media for updates or to send a nice message via Instagram and Facebook just by searching up the Storybox. It's that easy. Until we dive next week back into the Storybox, I'm Jay Phantom, and don't forget to share your story around. I'll catch you then. Ooh.